we're done with our dream eco home. Thanks to our helpful neighbor. Now, we can finally start on that 50,000-piece jigsaw puzzle.
Sorry to interrupt. Eco home, jigsaw puzzles.
Possible?
Can. Singlife has a plan for you. But I can't promise Pierre Pung.
Whatever your dream, Singlife is here to help you achieve it with financial freedom. Better way.
When you look after your people, they will look after the customers and the business will take care of each other. So every time we are faced with a challenge, we choose purpose because we want to serve the communities within which we operate.
At Greenpack, partnership is very important to us. We like to do business with like-minded companies who has a mission of contributing to the future of sustainability.
I feel it deep in my bones. Weightless and airborne. Skyline fades and all we know is riding where the dreams are.
Welcome to the CNA Summit 2025 Trade-Offs in Leadership. I'm Elizabeth Neo, and I present the business news on CNA's flagship morning program, Asia First. It's really good to have you join us this Thursday afternoon on our YouTube and LinkedIn live stream. We are, of course, broadcasting this from the Pan Pacific Singapore. Now, being a business leader involves strategic decision making. And one of the most challenging parts of this is navigating the trade-offs that come with it. And that is the focus of this year's CNA Summit, which will look at the tough choices leaders face within the organization that impact talent management, resource allocation, leadership style and culture, to the considerations leaders must make beyond the organization's boundaries that affect stakeholder expectations, market adaptation, partnerships and collaborations, even regulatory compliance as well as brand reputation. And so we've got notable policymakers and business leaders joining us today, including Mr. Desmond Lee. He is Minister for National Development as well as Minister in charge of Social Services Integration. Now, on our YouTube and LinkedIn live stream, we will bring you snippets of CNA's documentary, Leadership Unlimited. Leadership is not just about giving orders. It's also about trust, influence, and connection. Now, this clip explores how balancing competence with likability shapes better outcomes. Here's a look.
So in psychology, we have a theory called how we perceive people. There are two dimensions. One is called likability or agreeableness. The other one is called competence. Most students typically focus on demonstrating competence. That's why when they go to a negotiation, when they go to a meeting, a boardroom meeting, they try to exhibit that competence. They will talk a lot more. What's interesting is that research shows us that competence is very, very important, but likability comes first. If people don't like you, competence doesn't really matter. One of the best tools to build likability and build trust is by listening. Many students, they listen with the intent to respond to an argument. I want my students to listen with the intent to understand the argument first and then respond later. Your goal right now is to negotiate a limited product, in this case, flowers. I think it starts with self-awareness that as a leader, you're going to tell yourself that you're listening, not because you want to respond, but to understand what your followers truly wanted or what your counterpart in the negotiating table really wanted.
Like 50 is like below like my minimum threshold, which I would need. So like
to stick to 100,000 bid.
Ninety is too much. It's only 100 flowers.
Many times in negotiation, in leadership, we always think about our own interests 100% of the time. Now that's fine. What I'm finding in my work is that if you care about the other person's interests, in most of the time, you can actually better your own self-interest as well because you enlarge the pie, enlarge your value in front of both of us.
Now, in the insurance sector, trust and value go hand in hand. And joining us to share her insights is Helen Shin, Group Head of Products at at Sing Life. Helen, it's really lovely to have you on CNA Summit, of course. I just want to talk to you about, you know, your role as head of products at Sing Life. You know, as an insurance business, you know, that balances profits with providing affordable policies for customers, is it possible to do both?
Oh, yeah. It's definitely a balancing act. And, you know, that's why we are here and that's why there's an insurance industry. There's always, you know, today the theme is really about trade-offs. And while it seems like these two, you know, are at opposing ends, right? Profitability, customers, and making sure they have affordable policies. At the end of the day, if I think long-term, if I think for the future, they don't really feel at odds to me so much, right? We are looking at what is insurance for our customers. It's about protecting them. It's about protecting them for the long term and making sure that we are there on a sustainable basis and to make sure that we are there right where we need them. So the ability to do this actually rests in the affordability of the premiums and to make sure that we're looking at this from a long-term perspective. But from a short-term perspective, we're also balancing this. We're balancing this from a portfolio aspect. So for example, you'd be surprised to know that last year we launched a hospitalization plan for young adults, and the cash outlay is only $1 a year. You will say, that doesn't sound like a very profitable plan at all. But clearly, we are building some of these products to protect the young adults, to fix the protection gap in Singapore, and making sure that we are there when the customers need us the most, which is in that long term, in that sustainable future.
Yeah, it sure sounds like you've managed to, you know, balance the two demands pretty well. I want to talk to you about, you know, policy, social policy agendas. You know, I mean, customers, consumers these days, you know, they really expect something from corporations as well. And so do you find consumers are increasingly turning to corporations to pursue social policy agendas? And how is Sing Life balancing its social duties as well as the business?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We see that consumers today are a lot more open and a lot more have high expectations for corporations in terms of social responsibility. I'm a consumer myself too. We all do that. And at Sing Life, we take that responsibility very seriously. So to us, there is a community angle. Last year and the year before, we've launched Sing Life Care Collab. So that's a curator of brands and partners that we've put together and really taking care of our customers' needs, taking care of the many of the societies that are not top of mind. Like, for example, caregivers, right? We've also launched the Sing Life Dementia Cover. It's the first in the market, something that the society really needs as we go into aging population. So there's quite a lot that we've done really on the product space, on the innovation space, on the proposition space to make sure that we are protecting our customers and the society as a whole. But at the same time, we also think about our staff, our stakeholders, many of the partners, the public. So there's quite a lot that we are also doing beyond the products, right? It's not just the products, it's about the population as a whole. So as you might have seen, Sing Life has partnered with many organizations, the community, we're championing agility, championing empathy, sort of really going out and beyond that. So the bottom line is this, Liz. When you say trade-off, the operative word that comes to mind for me is actually balance, right? Is it trade-off? Is it balance? To me, the operative word is really, really about balance. And to me, balance means taking a long-term view and balancing profitability, balancing affordability, balancing what the society needs, what customer needs. But at the end of the day, keeping the consumer needs and our customer right at the heart of what we do.
All right, so it's all about perspective, isn't it? It's balance versus trade-off. Thank you so much, Helen. Really appreciate your time and for sharing your insights and what Sing Life is doing. Helen Schender, she is Group Head of Products at Sing Life. Now, before we head on to the next interview, I want to show you what's ahead at CNA Summit 2025.
CNA Summit 2025, Trade-Offs in Leadership. Presenting partner, Sing Life, a better way to financial freedom. The summit explores how leaders balance priorities, make tough decisions, and navigate complexity in an era of rapid change and uncertainty. Join the conversation as we bring together distinguished leaders from the public and private sector as they delve into critical internal trade-offs, including talent management, resource allocation, organizational design, and leadership style. while examining the strategic external trade-offs leaders must make to achieve stakeholder expectations, market adaption, partnerships, and brand reputation. The CNA Summit 2025 on the 20th February. Brought to you by MediaCorp. Impact Partner, MVPC. Main Partner, Oppo, Find N5.
Now, one of the key challenges for leaders today is balancing sustainability with business priorities. And up next, we will hear from Dr. Vicky Bandu, President of UN Global Compact Network Singapore, on how companies can navigate these trade-offs. So, Dr. Bandu, it's really good to have you on again. And I just want to talk to you. You know, as a leading voice on corporate sustainability, I mean, what are some of the trade-offs unique to the work that you do?
So we're a part of the UNGC, and, you know, the setup here is really about aligning to the 10 principles. There's 20,000 organizations and corporations that have come together, spanning across 170 countries, and our focus specifically in Singapore is to align against the 10 principles. The 10 principles that globally UNGC is aligned to is human rights, labor, environment, and anti-corruption. But specifically, when we look at those 10 principles, it's very fitting to some of the activities that we do here because we want to bring alignment between business strategies and the sustainable development goals. And that alignment sometimes is seen as a trade-off, but really it is about understanding how the strategies can implement and help businesses to grow whilst also delivering the sustainable development goals. And we've got about 250 representative companies from MNCs and SMEs that are part of our corporate network.
Yeah, and so what kind of trade-offs do you face when advocating for stricter sustainability policies, which of course are more important now than ever for corporates? And you know, that may affect, say, their profits, but of course have a wider economic impact as well. I mean, is there a way to kind of minimize the negative effects of these so-called trade-offs?
And many organizations start to look at sustainability, but then also look at it as the impact on the profit. And actually, I think that's the wrong thing to do. When we look at the trade-offs between sustainability and profitability, there is actually profitable sustainability. That's the agenda that we want to try and achieve. And when you look at organizations, and you can easily look at the cost of sustainability. And when you look at the cost of sustainability, it's about actually, what do I need to invest today to be able to achieve my SDGs alignment, for example? And actually, that's the wrong question to be looking at. It's actually the cost of non-sustainability. So I'll give you an example. If I'm a small business and my agenda is all about generating profit for the next weeks and months to come, that's okay. I'll be able to generate my profit and I'll probably have little bandwidth for sustainability. But if my agenda is about generating profit in the near term and looking at the long term to be able to be competitively advantaged in the 3 to 5 years to come, I need to start looking at what are the investments I need to make in sustainability today to be able to have that competitive advantage in the 3 to 5 years' time. So what do I need to be future-proof for my business? So that priority and trade-off, especially for SMEs, become really significant. And these are some of the things that we encourage SMEs to think about by not just the awareness in what's happening in the global agenda, but the tools that they might be able to use, the frameworks that they might be able to adopt, and some of the practices and learnings that other organizations are doing that might be relevant for them as well.
I mean, for SMEs, they definitely face challenges, you know, investing in this sort of ESG sort of policies and initiatives, right? Funding is one area that is always, you know, it's hard to talk about as well. And so how you convince companies to integrate or incorporate ESG principles into their business strategies and convince them to sometimes prioritize this over profits? I mean, especially in the short term where you will feel the pain for sure, but then it's all about what happens in the long term, right?
Yes. You're right. It is absolutely about planning for the future. We've got regulatory changes that are happening globally that is going to start to impact the cost of doing business when we're trading in Singapore or out of Singapore. And I'll give you an example. In Europe, there's a carbon tax. So any goods that are imported into Europe, there's a carbon adjustment mechanism that really translates into carbon pricing. that then gets translated into your business accounts. And actually, this is a headwind that's coming very, very, very strongly. And if we're not prepared for it, we can no longer be able to trade with that sort of entity. So this way, we need to take a step back and see, understand the regulatory environment. I totally appreciate that SMEs are resource constrained. They haven't got the bandwidth, they haven't got the finance, they haven't got access to technology. But this is where the partnerships, this is where the cohesion, this is where trade associations and the chambers in Singapore are so well set up to give the SMEs the leg up. We've just recently announced our Singapore budget. There's a big, significant draw to support SMEs, and particularly with their sustainability agenda. Using carbon bonds, using investments in technologies, making the processes more energy efficient. So we've got to be able to join the dots for ourselves to be much more future ready.
So that's your experience when you're talking about SMEs. What about the large corporations that you work with as well? How does UNGC Singapore balance the engagement with large corporations, which they obviously have more resources? Funding is not really such a big issue when it comes to devoting those resources to sustainability. So what is the difference here? And is there anything that, as a small SME, any lessons that we can learn from bigger corporations, even though they may not have, of course, the funding and resources? But
I think when we look at SMEs, when we look at MNCs, you're absolutely right. There's a plan. There's a strategy that hopefully embeds sustainability as part of the agenda. But the intersection of challenges that MNCs face is when you execute the plan into operations, is that sustainability agenda being carried off from the long-term plan to what we're doing on our day-to-day activities and how we're reporting on a yearly basis? Which is why having that accountability, having that sort of audit yourselves, when you look at board representation, about two-thirds of the board agenda in MNCs focuses on financials, on audit, on risk, on compliance, on operations. Sustainability tends to have a less of a priority, whereas actually the same conversation and the same sort of hypothesis which can impact SMEs in the long run can also impact the MNCs. So we want to encourage more accountability from MNCs. We want to encourage more transparency in terms of the data and the reporting that they're doing and the goodness that they're doing in sustainability. This is not about penalizing organizations. It's actually about celebrating success. And that's where entities like the UNGCNS and various other trade associations and chambers come together to share some of the success stories with others so that we can take that goodness, not just to other organizations, but through the whole ecosystem of Singapore, including SMEs.
Now, you can't talk about ESG without talking about greenwashing. And so how do you ensure that companies that join the UNGC Singapore are there to make a genuine impact and not just for branding purposes, right?
Genuine impact is so important. It is, you've got to take that accountability and we've got to have that transparency. Actually being able to measure what you're doing, monitor what you're doing, and then on a regular basis report what you're doing. And that transparency of the reporting allows organizations to see the progress that they're making in some of the areas and what more we need to do to be able to support the organizations that might be sort of falling a little bit short to the commitments that they might have set. So this is why I think it's really important that we look at MNCs and we look at the transparencies and look at the commitments that they're making and encourage and continue that sort of approach that many have already adopted.
I also want to talk about, so you're in charge of the Singapore unit of the UNGC, and I want to know how, you balance this with the international landscape, the goals, faced by international, on an international scale, which, if we look at Singapore alone, we face unique challenges. But how are you working to align this with international goals?
And I think we've all appreciate that even over the last few months, the landscape has changed quite significantly. There are significant geopolitical shifts that's bringing together the agenda once again and questioning the agenda in some sense of sustainability. We've got to look at those headwinds, but at the same time, we've also got to look at the opportunities that this faces. Southeast Asia is still one of the most growing regions in the world. We've got an opportunity, a fantastic opportunity to step up into this space and carry on some of the goodness that we've already started within the region. We've just shared our recent announcements, and the government shared the recent announcements on the greenhouse gas emissions, you know, dropping that from the 60 million tons to 45 to 50 million tons by 2030. It's great advancements.
Yeah.
We see loads of organizations, not just in Singapore, but in Japan, Korea, Australia, where the leadership of those multinational companies are taking great advancements in the sustainability agenda. We're seeing green financing coming in ASEAN, India, and China. We're seeing Japan committing to net zero by 2050.
Yeah.
So we see this region as actually a vibrant, and I would say a great position and a great opportunity to embrace as a leader in the sustainability agenda.
Dr. Bang, we really appreciate you sharing this with us, and thank you so much for your time, and I hope you have a good session here at CNA Summit. That was Dr. Vicky Bangu there. He's president of the UN Global Compact Network Singapore. Now, in a few moments, we will be taking you into our ballroom where we will be kicking off the summit. Of course, this would not have been possible without our partners, and I just want to take a moment to thank them. Our presenting partner is Sing Life. Our impact partner is the National Volunteer and Philanthropy Center, or NPVC. And our main partner is Oprah. Once again, a big thank you to our partners for making today's summit possible. Now, I want to shift our focus to leadership in the investment sector, where navigating trade-offs and driving innovation are key. And joining us next is Nicole Schmidt. She is Managing Director for Asia Pacific at Bridgewater Associates. Nicole, of course, will be sharing insights on leadership challenges, communication strategies, and so much more. Nicole, thank you so much for making the time, and appreciate you sharing with us, you know, what you're going to be sharing in the next couple of minutes. So I'm going to start off about the unique challenges that you see and the trade-offs that you see in the investment sector. And based on your experience, I mean, what have you navigated? How have you overcome them?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. It's very exciting to be here. Look, everything comes down to having alignment at the top of your organization on what your goals are and what you're trying to do. At Bridgewater, we have been deeply researching in markets and economies for 50 years, and that is core to what we want to do. And ultimately, our goal is to take that understanding that we've developed and create really great solutions for our clients and partner with them on their biggest investment challenges. And if you think through, okay, how do I as a leader then navigate making trade-offs and different challenges, everything has to anchor back to what that goal is as an organization. And so there's a couple of things. I think from a business perspective, the things that we're constantly trying to balance are, how do you think about balancing short-term performance and long-term sustainability? How do you ensure that as an investment organization, you're fostering creativity and innovation, but balancing that with discipline? And those are hard things to balance and trade off. And I think the key to doing that successfully is making sure that you do that with the long-term vision in sight. You want to have long-term sustainability. You want to make sure that you're anchored to the goal of delivering for your clients. And we do that by managing our organization, I would say, very conservatively, so that you can be nimble in terms of managing different environments and managing your organization through those things. And then there's people. I think people is a very critical and important part of that strategy. And there's challenges there, too. It's really hard to be an investor. You want to have top investment talent. You need to hold a really high bar for the people at your organization and balance that with also giving them the space to really develop and learn while making sure that you're holding a high bar. And so those are trade-offs that you're constantly trying to navigate. But I think, you know, just tying it back to what's our goal is really what we anchor all of our decisions in.
And indeed, because you are senior leader in Bridgewater Singapore and the Singapore office. And so how do you communicate these trade-offs up and down the line, right?
Yeah. Look, it all comes down to transparency. If you think about Bridgewater, you think about transparency. And transparency is critical. That's both whether you're managing with your stakeholders, whether you're managing things with your team, and when you're communicating with clients. Transparency is ultimately the thing that is going to create trust. And so as a leader, it's important and incumbent on you to make sure that you're being transparent with that thought process. And if you tie it back to, okay, if I'm communicating and being transparent, that everything I'm doing and the decisions I'm making and the trade-offs all tie back to what our goal is as an investment manager, as an institution, I think it really helps bring people along in that journey and help them to follow you on that mission. And so transparency is key.
I noticed another word that you used quite a few times in your first response, and that is the word balance.
Yeah.
And so I want to ask you if it's possible to have your cake and eat it too.
If you can figure that out, please let me know.
I thought you would have the answer to that.
I think it's hard. I don't think there's have your cake and eat it too. I think, you know, you're always going to have to make trade-offs. And the things in my career that I have felt are most helpful and most valuable is, one, stick to your values. Integrity is all you have. Don't make trade-offs on those things. And I think that's the most important things. And so if you stay true to what your organization's values are, what you're focused on, like, that's the most important thing. Don't make trade-offs there. And at the end, you're going to have to make trade-offs everywhere else. And that's just, I think that's part of being a leader, is being able to wisely navigate how you do those things. But again, if you can figure it out, please let me know. I'd love to know how you can have it all.
Before me, let me know. I want to look at Outlook. Right. We're in a challenging landscape economically, politically, in geopolitics and all that. And so what kind of trade-offs, what kind of challenges will Bridgewater have to navigate up ahead? And in general, what should investment companies be prepared for?
Yeah. So there's a couple things. Exactly what you said. We are in a very unique and very rapidly evolving investment landscape where you're going to have a period of macro volatility. Things geopolitically are changing very quickly, and the investment landscape is changing very quickly. So one of the things that has been core for us is I think it's critically important to have a process, especially as an investment manager, that is set up to uniquely and flexibly be able to navigate this environment. We have a very robust systematic process that we have built up over 50 years that has gone through various cycles and helped us navigate that very well. And so I think first and foremost is making sure that you have a process that can consume and take in. I mean, there's so much data coming at us. The world is changing very rapidly. So being able to nimbly, flexibly, and very quickly navigate that so you can see, you know, 2 and 3 steps down the line and be able to make investment decisions is critically important. And then I'd say there's two main things that we are critically focused on. One is AI. I know you hear it every day, probably everywhere, but it is transforming at a rapid pace, and it's influencing markets, it's influencing economies, it's going to influence the way that we work, that people work. And so at Bridgewater, we've basically been focused on it from two perspectives. One, as a global investor, it's critically important to understand the impact that AI is going to have on markets and economies. If you're going to trade markets, you need to know what that means for markets. And the second thing is then how we can actually use AI to generate alpha in markets and have an investment strategy that's machine learning focused. And so those are the two things that we've been focused on. Going back to 2012, our co-CIO, Greg Jensen, has been critically focused on this. I think we're at the forefront of it. And I think as an investment institution, you need to be focused on this because we are at a critical inflection point in when it comes to AI. And then in all the conversations we're having with our investors, look, we talked about a period of macro volatility. I think the investing landscape is going to be challenging in the years ahead. So how do we work with our clients who are thinking about how can I have a more resilient portfolio through this period? And how do we, Bridgewater, bring the best of our understanding, the best of our investment expertise to our clients more flexibly to give them better solutions that are going to help them navigate this period ahead and really have a more resilient portfolio?
So it's uncertain, But it can be exciting. It's what you make of it. Thank you so much. Yeah. Nicole, really appreciate your time and your insights this afternoon. Thanks for joining us at CNA Summit.
Thank you for
Nicole Schmidt there. She is Managing Director for Asia Pacific at Bridgewater Associates. Of course, she has been sharing about the challenges on leadership, communication strategies, as well as the evolving landscape of investment.
We're done with our dream eco home. Thanks to our helpful neighbor. Now, we can finally start on that 50,000-piece jigsaw puzzle.
Sorry to interrupt. EcoHome, jigsaw puzzles.
Possible?
Can. Singlife has a plan for you. But I can't promise Pierre Pung.
Whatever your dream, Singlife is here to help you achieve it with financial freedom. A better way.
When you look after your people, they will look after the customers and the business will take care of each other. So every time we are faced with a challenge, we choose purpose because we want to serve the communities within which we operate.
At Greenpack, partnership is very important to us. We like to do business with like-minded companies who has a mission of contributing to the future of sustainability.
I feel it deep in my bones. Weightless and airborne. Skyline fades and all we know is riding where the dreams are.
Well, if you're just joining us, a very warm welcome to you. You're watching the CNA Summit Trade-Offs in Leadership. And of course, we're coming to you live from the Pan Pacific Singapore. I'm your host, Elizabeth Neo. And we're about to kick things off with an address by MediaCorp CEO, Ms. Tam Lok Hing, followed by a keynote address by Mr. Desmond Lee. He is Minister for National Development and Minister in Charge of Social Services Integration that is taking place in the ballroom just beside me. Of course, there's plenty going on today right here on top of the opening address by Ms. Tam Lok Hing, which is our MediaCorp CEO, as well as Minister Desmond Lee, who is Minister for National Development and Minister in Charge of Social Services Integration. We will be having a panel discussion as well. The first panel discussion set to take place very shortly after the two addresses will be on internal trade-offs. And so this panel explores really, you know, the tough choices that leaders face on internal dynamics within the organization that impact internal stakeholders, processes and resources such as talent management, resource allocation, organizational design, leadership style, cultural transformation as well. And that's going to be moderated by my colleague, Andrea Hing. She's a presenter at CNA 938. And the panelists on that session include top executives from Citi that we're going to be speaking with Mr. Tibor Pandey. He is the Singapore Country Officer and Banking Head at Citi. We've got Mr. Kok Ping Soon, Chief Executive Officer at Singapore Business Federation, as well as Ms. Perlin Pao. She is a Group Chief Executive Officer at Singlife. So plenty going on. And we will be taking you into our ballroom right now.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Hello, everyone. Welcome, welcome, a warm welcome. Great to see so many of you here. Minister Desmond Lee, Minister for National Development, Minister in Charge of Social Services Integration, Your Excellencies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, a very warm welcome to the CNA Summit 2025 on trade-offs in leadership. Thank you for taking the time to join us this afternoon. Just very quickly, a shout out to our sponsors who are supporting this summit, presenting partner Singlife, Impact Partner, National Volunteer and Philanthropy Center, NVPC, and main partner OPPO. My name is Stephen Chia. I'm a CNA presenter. I host a show called Talking Point. How many of you have watched Talking Point? All put up your hands. Make me feel good. Thank you. Oh, that's nice to hear. As you know, it's a show that delves into a lot of interesting things. We try and break it down, break down the issues that we feel matter and impact people who are living here in Singapore. And on top of that, I also host a podcast called Deep Dive, where we also look at the issues that are affecting us here in Singapore. So I'm very happy to be helping out today at this event. We want to welcome you, and of course, I've already told you a reminder to keep your phones on silent mode. And later on, during our panel discussions, there will be a chance for questions. So you've seen the QR code on your table. Feel free to log it in and send us some questions. Now, let's get to today's topic. I'm going to phrase it a bit differently. To eat or not to eat? Okay, you've all eaten. That's why we invited you after lunch. But come lunchtime, that decision is easy. You want to eat. But you kind of think to yourself, should I go and have my favorite Hokkien Mee or Nasi Goreng in a hawker center, sweat it out? Or I can go eat a burger, not so exciting, but be in cool air conditioning comfort. So there is a trade-off, right? You're thinking one for the other, taste versus comfort. Now, we're living in a time of unprecedented change and uncertainty, and many of us are faced with making a lot of complex decisions on a daily basis. The stakes are really high, and the margin for error is very small. People are unforgiving. Success is no longer defined solely by internal efficiency or profitability. It hinges on how well leaders navigate all these external and internal circumstances. Managing, you know, stakeholder expectations, balancing competing priorities. There's so many things you have to look at. So what are the trade-offs? How can you better negotiate that fine balance? And how do you unite people to support all these decisions that you're making? Our keynote speaker and the two panels that follow will discuss these issues, the internal and external corporate trade-offs. And we will also explore the critical factors that distinguish resilient and successful organizations from those that struggle to adapt. So once again, I encourage you to be part of this discussion. We look forward to having questions that we can pose to our panel. So do take part in that pigeonhole conversation. But to kick things off, let me first invite MediaCorp's Chief Executive Officer, Ms. Tam Lok King, to come forward and say a few words. Lok King, please.
Good afternoon, guest of honour, Minister for National Development, Desmond Lee, distinguished guests, friends and colleagues. A very, very warm welcome to the CNA Summit. It is my pleasure to see so many of you here in person. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. And also a very equally warm welcome to our viewers from across Asia who are tuning in to CNA's live streams on YouTube and LinkedIn. The CNA Summit is our flagship thought leadership, which brings together political leaders, captains of industry, the diplomatic corps, academics, newsmakers, to really analyze and engage on topical issues. Last year, we discussed how trust matters. Building on that, in today's summit, we will discuss trade-offs in leadership and take a deep dive into the strategic thinking and the decision-making process that leaders must master to manage often competing priorities. This is evidence in governance, of course, but I will respectfully leave that for Minister Desmond Lee to discuss the trade-offs in policy and governance and confine my remarks to the business sphere. No matter what business it is that we operate in, the landscape we face today has come to be defined by that very popular acronym VUCA: volatility, uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity. This creates a leadership environment where trade-offs are unavoidable. Do we move quickly, or do we take time to analyze data and mitigate risks? Should we have central control, or should we empower our teams to and allow inconsistencies? How do we balance that need for operational stability and fostering innovation? How do we achieve high growth, but at the same time, think about long-term sustainability? I'm sure that these are the trade-offs and the thoughts that all of us have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. And the list is endless. And the list of skills that leaders have to bring to the table to also meet these trade-offs are also endless. We are expected to have adaptive thinking, that ability to make decisions in ambiguity. We have to have emotional intelligence to navigate the tensions between teams and stakeholders, and also the skill to communicate strategically and yet authentically. Sometimes being able to master all of this at the same time really feels like a Herculean challenge, at least to me. But I suppose, you know, I would like to also share with everyone examples of the many trade-offs that we deal with in MediaCorp. It is, you know, clear that in the past decade, the audience landscape has become increasingly fragmented. Like many other businesses, we want to establish that direct relationship with our consumers. We want that deep engagement, which can happen in what we call our own and operated or O&O platforms, such as our own apps. But at the same time, we also want to grow our base of consumers beyond our platforms and reaching audiences in other platforms, which in our case, you know, are usually global social media platforms. And these third-party platforms are accretive to our reach, but we have to consider whether they would impact that deep relationship that we have with our consumers in our own environments. Sometimes it is possible to have your cake and eat it. Since 2018, we made that tough decision to put all of CNA's video content available on the YouTube platform and not just our own platforms. We have since enjoyed a significant increase in our reach, not just locally and regionally, but also to a global audience. So much so that we have now been able to launch specific streaming services in the US and the UK for CNA. Beyond YouTube, we also recognize the growing importance of social platforms like TikTok. They enabled us to engage new, digitally connected audiences in short-form and shareable content. The rise of social media has also resulted in fundamental changes in our strategy. Previously, we would think about social platforms purely to promote our content and to drive traffic back to our own O&O platforms. But habits evolve. Audiences now expect to complete that experience and complete their consumption on such social media platforms. And we have to serve our audiences where they are. And yet, at the same time, we have to invest in deepening that engagement and lengthening the time that they spend with us through innovative new formats as well as storytelling techniques. So, for example, MediaCorp has recently broken new ground in the new microdrama space. If you're not clear what that is, there are 1-2 minute per episode dramas with productions such as Falling for the CEO's Son, not mine, and our Sunny Side Up spin-off, Break the Silence, both of which very quickly accumulated 6 million views each. It's not just microdramas that are gaining traction on social media, of course. CNA has found a new audience on TikTok, and to date, we have reached 1 million followers for CNA with an audience reach of 332 million, and that's 366% growth from a year ago. That said, obviously, there is that constant push and pull for us. How much do we invest where? How do we balance the needs of our own platforms while wanting to be present everywhere that our audiences are? But all the while, we still have to maintain trust and maintain the high quality of content that aligns with our mission as Singapore's national media network. So you know, what is the trade-off? We have finite resources, as everyone else in the room does. And we have to think about how to channel these resources into all the contending needs that we have. And stretching all of us to meet the needs in this kind of ever-changing, you know, really fast-paced environment really weighs heavily on our staff. Operating in a high-speed, high-performance environment can only be viable, therefore, when we have people-focused safeguards in place. We need to invest consciously to support our teams, both physically as well as mentally. To me, this is not a trade-off. It is the critical cornerstone that is necessary if we are going to be operating successfully in a VUCA environment. In closing, please allow me to thank our panelists for being with us today. I look forward to your insights. And I would also like to thank our partners for your unwavering support in bringing today's event to fruition. Thank you very much. I'll speak to all of you later.
Thank you, Looking, for sharing that. I think it's true. There is always a trade-off in everything we do every day. And, you know, to stay relevant, to stay agile, to stay connected with our audiences, for us, that is the challenge. And it's not an easy task. Now, I would like to invite our guest of honor, Minister Desmond Lee, to come forward and give his keynote address. Minister, please.
Ms. Tham Lok King, CEO of MediaCorp, friends from the diplomatic corps, leaders from industry, community, and the media, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I'm delighted to be able to join you here at the CNA Summit, which explores how leaders across different sectors manage tensions and trade-offs to achieve strategic outcomes. Actually, when you look at Singapore, you see tight constraints. We are a very small island city-state, no natural resources, no hinterland, vulnerable to the external environment. As a principle, we strive to do more and to do better for Singaporeans and to avoid making stark binary trade-offs wherever possible. But inevitably, when constraints become more binding, we will have to manage tensions and make difficult trade-offs between competing objectives. For instance, given limited resources, do we meet today's pressing needs? Or do we save more for tomorrow's generation? Do we conserve or do we develop? How do we manage diverse and sometimes conflicting aspirations of different groups of Singaporeans? Now, despite these tight constraints, we've built a thriving global hub and vibrant city over six decades. We are home to a world-class seaport and air hub, a leading financial centre, and with a home ownership rate of close to 90% in a city in nature. We've built a thriving global hub and vibrant city and are celebrating 60 years of nation building, or SG60, this year. But certainly in the years ahead, we will face even greater headwinds and challenges. The economic and geopolitical outlook is uncertain. Our population is ageing. Technology-driven disruptions will be even more rapid. And we have to grapple with existential threats like climate change and rising sea levels. Like our pioneers, we strive to turn our challenges into opportunities. Prime Minister Lawrence Wong announced the SG60 budget 2 days ago, addressing current concerns, but also taking the long view to prepare Singapore and invest heavily in Singaporeans, so that we can seize future opportunities amidst turbulence and uncertainty. Today, I will describe how we manage some of the tensions and trade-offs that we face in urban planning, namely five of our land optimization strategies, our four core approaches that guide them, and the three enablers that make them possible. I will then illustrate these in two foundational areas, as well as our singular goal in urban planning, for Singapore as a city to remain livable, sustainable, and exceptional. One of the most obvious constraints for us is land. There are many pressing demands for land. At the same time, while we are a city, we also have to fit everything that a sovereign country needs within our city limits. This creates tremendous pressures. But over the decades, we've developed strategies to overcome some of these constraints, turn a challenge into an opportunity. First, as good stewards of land and resources, we optimize through intensification, build upwards and make use of vertical spaces. We also build mixed-use developments that integrate residential, commercial, and recreational spaces to reap benefits between synergistic users and to make our spaces more vibrant. One example would be Guok Ko Tower, a mixed-use development in Singapore's city centre, an ambitious 38-storey vertical city that comprises commercial, residential, retail, hotel, and green elements. Another example, our Tampines Hub, Singapore's largest integrated community and lifestyle hub. We have integrated a stadium and sports facilities, retail, a hawker centre, and a slew of other amenities in one single building. If we had to conventionally allocate individual land parcels for each of these users, the amount of land and resources consumed would have been much more. So that's first, optimise, intensify. Second, we try to unlock new spaces. One way is through reclamation. For example, more than 40 years ago, our pioneers decided to reclaim land to give us options to expand our city centre. This has allowed us to create a new business and financial hub, which you know as Marina Bay and Marina South. Another way is to go underground. For example, the Jurong Rock Caverns, Southeast Asia's first underground hydrocarbon storage cavern, is 150 metres below the ground level. This has freed up 60 hectares of surface land for other users. Third, we recycle our land and carry out strategic redevelopment. Brownfield sites can be repurposed for new developments, allowing us to reallocate spaces to meet both current and future needs. One major example would be Paya Lebar Air Base, which we will relocate to Changi from the 2030s onwards. This move will give us the opportunity to comprehensively redevelop the 800-hectare site and its surrounding industrial estates into a highly livable and sustainable new town. Fourth, we try to innovate to maximise our usage of space. Take the East Coast Integrated Depot, set to open in 2026. This will be the first of its kind in the world. It combines a multi-storey train depot as well as a bus depot. This will save us 44 hectares worth of land or 60 football fields and save 40% in construction cost. Fifth, we need to constantly think about and develop big strategic moves today for the prosperity of tomorrow. We must be prepared to reimagine our urban spaces, to create space and bandwidth for us to do even more. Take the Greater Southern Waterfront. It will be a major gateway for urban living along Singapore's southern coast. To free up large tracts of prime waterfront land, we are moving existing ports in Tanjung Pagar and Pasir Panjang westwards to the Tuas Megaport. This also allows port operations to be more efficient. When completed in the 2040s, Tuas Megaport will be the world's largest fully automated port. Now, at the core of it, there are four key approaches driving the five important optimization strategies that I've just mentioned earlier. The first is disciplined long-term planning. We have institutionalized this in our land use planning since the 1950s. Every 10 years, we undertake what we call a long-term plan review to plan 50 years into the future. Because land use changes take a long time to bring into effect. We then translate these planning strategies into a detailed master plan of every part of Singapore: housing, industry, recreation, healthcare, and more, for the next 10 to 15 years. Second, we bring agencies and stakeholders together to execute and implement effectively, preparing the land, putting in the infrastructure like roads and utilities and services, addressing pain points and disamenities as we roll out the projects and developments. Third, some plans are much longer term and benefit future generations. So we must be prepared to embark on projects that take decades to bear fruit and have the political will and the resources to follow through. These innovative projects are not easy, require time, effort, and resources to overcome complex technical challenges. Yet, we pursue them because the longer-term benefits are clear. They transform constraints such as land scarcity into catalysts for forward-thinking urban solutions and sustainable growth. For example, Long Island. It is an ambitious plan to reimagine our southeastern coast. It will protect our low-lying East Coast area against future sea level rise, and also create space for future needs such as housing, recreation, and jobs, and a new reservoir of fresh water to enhance our water security. It will take many decades to complete, and we've just started. But we have to start coastal protection work now, because the price of delay or failure will be too high for future generations to have to bear. Fourth, even while we plan for the long term, we should also stay nimble and agile and be prepared to refresh our plans and even change them to keep pace with emerging trends and developments. This was particularly important during black swan events like the COVID pandemic. We had to find land and adapt spaces for additional medical facilities, for dorms, and other urgent uses. Now, while our five optimization strategies in urban planning and our four core approaches help us to overcome land and other constraints, there are three important enablers that must be in place to help us turn vision into reality. One, technology, AI, and digital tools. We've always been pushing boundaries in using technology and digital tools to plan, design, and build more efficiently. Recent developments in artificial intelligence can only add to this. For example, the Digital and Planning Lab at the URA has been integrating GIS, or Geographical Information System technology, big data analytics, and modeling and simulation tools into the URA's urban planning processes. These help our planners to anticipate changes in demographic needs or activity, as well as mobility patterns, to enhance our precision, efficiency, and foresight. Two, we must engage the public and our stakeholders extensively and deeply. We conduct briefings, dialogues, town halls, citizen panels, and more to develop plans with the public and for people with different interests and perspectives to hear from one another. We do this for many of our major plans. In fact, just yesterday evening, I was at an engagement at URA with 160 young Singaporeans on our draft master plan. More than 100 questions. To better understand our evolving housing needs, we have also engaged 16,000 people in our Forward Singapore engagements since 2022. And this has guided real policy changes. I give you just one example. Due to public consensus in our housing conversations under Forward Singapore, we adjusted our public housing policy in 2023 to give even greater public housing priority for parents and married couples who are buying their very first home. As a result, about 9 in 10 of such applicants have so far been invited to book a flat in categories where they're given first priority at the first try. We also create Alliances for Action, or AFAs, where government partners Singaporeans to address common challenges. Each member contributes their perspectives and resources, and together as an Alliance for Action, we achieve more than the sum of our individual efforts. Three, our success has been anchored thus far by our strong social compact. This compact embodies a mutual understanding. While government is committed to doing its part, Singaporeans also play a critical role. For generations, Singaporeans have looked beyond our own personal interests and made sacrifices. Now, you know, aspirations can outstrip the reality of our size and our resources. Yet a truly successful society is one where everyone succeeds together. And for this to happen, we must continue to foster a strong sense of collective responsibility and to constantly think of the next generation's needs. These principles are not new. Let me just talk about two examples where our pioneers also faced trade-offs, in fact, far more intense than today, and make difficult but necessary decisions to open new pathways for Singapore's longer-term success. One example is public housing. In our early years, we started public housing and the HDB to address urgent housing shortages and poor living conditions. Our pioneers also had a clear vision that owning a home would give Singaporeans a strong stake in our fledgling nation. Now, for them, it was not just about building flats or estates, but building a nation. At the same time, there was no certainty that this was the better path. Like many other countries, we might have left it to the private sector, while the government provided basic housing as a social safety net. But they decided rightly that this would not have achieved the same social and economic outcomes. Home ownership could end up out of reach for many if left entirely to the private sector and market forces. So our pioneers chose to take the more difficult path. Government had to acquire land, and there was a large fiscal cost to build our public housing estates over the decades. But their vision has paid off. Today, around 80% of Singaporeans live in HDB public housing, and we have one of the highest homeownership rates in the world. Through our public housing system, we have been able to pursue many important social objectives. So housing not just as infrastructure, but principally as social policy, such as fostering an inclusive society, promoting multiculturalism, supporting the aspirations of families, and better supporting our seniors as they age in place, empowering vulnerable groups through policies like Comlink Plus, for instance. As the largest developer of housing in Singapore, HDB also pushes the boundaries in technology adoption. Today, it is our turn to carry on the work that our pioneers started. But society evolves and our public housing policies must keep pace. For example, we want to ensure that all places remain accessible to Singaporeans from different walks of life. So we support social mixing in our public housing estates. We have seen that in other metropolitan cities and societies, homes in attractive locations, more central locations, are more expensive, and over time they become accessible only to the wealthy, while others are pushed further out into the suburbs or further in to deprived inner cities. This stratifies society and stokes tensions between different groups of the haves and the have-nots. To try to counter these forces, we implemented the new flat classification framework, Standard, Plus, and Prime. This major policy move will enable us to build affordable public housing in choicier and more central areas, such as the Greater Southern Waterfront, Bukit Timah Turf City, and others, to keep our neighbourhoods and communities diverse while ensuring that the system of public subsidies remain fair. Our public rental flats can also be found in more areas across Singapore, even in plus and prime locations, and integrated with other BTO flats. In fact, our very first prime location public housing project in Rochor has rental flats built in with sole flats. This gives our families in public rental housing better access too to the same facilities, schools and other amenities. We cannot take present success for granted. We must continue to keep improving our foundations for our next generation. Let me highlight another foundational example, our city in nature. Today, we are one of the greenest cities in the world. We have nature reserves and nature areas in the heart of the city, parks and green spaces across the island, and diverse marine habitats in our waters. This did not happen by chance. Think about it. In the 1960s, newly independent and newly industrializing, small, densely populated Singapore could easily have become a concrete jungle, a city of brick, mortar, and steel, like so many other cities. In fact, if you look at old archival photos of Singapore and the city area, you won't see that many trees. But from the outset, our founding Prime Minister, the late Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, saw what greening could mean for Singapore. So the highly pragmatic idealist. He saw that it would give people respite from the city, distinguish ourselves and attract investments back then. Greenery could also be a social leveller where all Singaporeans had access to green spaces. And so over the past 60 years, successive generations of Singaporeans have been stewarding our environment, intentionally building a green and livable city, even as we face ever more intense land use pressures. When we must continue this work so that future generations can enjoy the same livable environment. Now, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew once said, and I quote, "We face tremendous odds with an improbable chance of survival," unquote. And over the past 60 years, we've not just survived, but managed to thrive. Looking ahead, we will continue to face immense challenges. If we focus only on binary trade-offs, allow competing tensions to pull society apart, or fail to steward our land and resources well, then we risk succumbing to the odds of improbability. But our history has shown us that instead of choosing between one or the other, we have constantly found ways to try to do more with so much less, to grow our economy, create good jobs, while creating a livable home for Singaporeans, to build a thriving metropolis while respecting our heritage and natural environment. This is possible only because generations of Singaporeans have remained committed to one another through a strong social compact. As Prime Minister Lawrence Wong said during his budget speech, and I quote, "At every turn, we've chosen determination over despair, innovation over stagnation, and solidarity over division," unquote. Everything flows from this. Our ability to plan long-term, make trade-offs fairly, rally Singaporeans to make sacrifices for the common wider good, and deal with whatever challenges might come our way. With our refreshed social compact under Forward SG, I'm confident that we have what it takes for future challenges and opportunities, to turn future challenges into opportunities and to bring Singapore to greater heights. With that, thank you and good afternoon.
Thank you, Minister, for sharing that. I think it's not surprising for any of us, you know, when you have guests coming to visit from overseas, they'll say how green Singapore is. And it really is a remarkable sight, and it really is something that was, you know, we made a concerted effort to do. And of course, when you take some of these risks, there are challenges because you don't know how it's going to turn out. And so there is a trade-off as well. Well, we're going to look more into this issue, and let me start inviting some of the guests up because maybe Andrea can come on stage. She is from our flagship morning show on CNA 938, that's our radio station, Asia First, and she's also the popular Money Talks podcast.
Yes.
And she's going to be hosting our next panel.
Yeah.
And I believe as we chat, they can bring up the seats.
Yeah.
So that our guests will have somewhere to sit. But yeah, how many of you have heard of Money Talks? I mean, we all know Money Talks.
Fewer hands
you know.
Than yours. Fewer hands than yours. It's okay. You don't have to make me happy.
Yeah, give us a 30-second spiel.
Money Talks basically is a podcast by CNA. We talk about anything under the sun that involves personal finance. You want to talk about CPF, you want to talk about your MediSave, you know, all those things involving the budget that just came out. That's where you want to tune in to. We are released every Tuesday. That's where you want to tune in. I am also, I assure you, always in your ear every weekday morning. I may not be as famous as you, Steve, but
no.
I'm always in your ear.
I'm way past the morning. Those early mornings are bygone era.
I'm glad you brought that up. It's a very early hours of the morning.
That's right.
That I'm in your ear, 7 to 10 a.m. on CNA 93 every Monday and to Friday. My trade-off is sleep.
Okay.
How I look like this is thanks to makeup. So I'll have to give credit to them.
And this was all not rehearsed, not in the script, but you can tell she works for radio because if I don't stop her, she can keep on talking. No, because it's a talk
and
show.
And that's what I'm hired to do.
Okay.
That's why I'm sitting
so we
here
got
today.
The chairs up. I'm going to head off stage. Andrea,
thank
stage
you for
is all
sharing
yours.
The stage with me. Thank you very much. Once again, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the CNA Summit. Really glad to have you with us today. It is an honor to share the stage here with our esteemed panelists, also to be in the presence of your of all of you as well. Now, as Stephen introduced, I'm Andrea Heng, host of the Money Talks podcast as well as Asia First on CNA 938. I assure you, what I do in the mornings, it's worth the trade-off of sleep. So, for today's panel, we're focusing on internal trade-offs. Now, these are the difficult decisions that leaders have to face within their organizations. Judgment calls on internal dynamics that have an impact on internal stakeholders like you and me, processes and resources. These can include talent management. How do we manage our workforce to encompass both expertise and diversity? You want to have everyone covered under the umbrella. Resource allocation. How do we prioritize between innovation and efficiency? Organizational design. Taking a look at centralization and decentralization of those processes, of those resources that you have, while acquiring new ones. Leadership style. That's what you're here for. Encouraging autonomy while maintaining a sense of balance in control. And cultural transformation, striking a balance between preserving heritage and driving change, because that's what you need to grow. Now, the questions that they must ask themselves, all to achieve a sustainable vision for your organization. So, it's a lucky day for you and me, because I'm honored to be accompanied by leaders in each of their organizations, in each of their own rights. Let me introduce my panelists now and invite them on stage. Ms. Perlin Pao, Group Chief Executive Officer of Singlife. And she will be joined by Mr. Tibor Pandey, Singapore Country Officer and Banking Head of Citi. And last but certainly not least, filling up the last seat there, Mr. Kok Ping Soon. He is the Chief Executive Officer of the Singapore Business Federation. Yeah, have a seat. And nice in pink in the middle there, the rose. All right, so let's kick things off. We want to first do some housekeeping notes here. Well, ladies and gentlemen, while we are getting comfortable, think about some of the questions that you want to ask our panelists today. Then submit them via the QR code that you see on your tables. Scan it. Key in the password CNA 2025 when prompted. We will take your questions towards the end of the session, so you do have some time to formulate and decide what you want to ask our panelists. All right, and we will take your questions at the end of the towards the end of the session. We'll leave plenty of time for that. All right, let's get started. Are we ready, ladies and gentlemen? All right, so we kick things off with you, Tibor, right at the end there. Tell us about the most pivotal point in your own career where you were identified as a promising talent for an employer to groom you into what you are today.
This is a question that I'm sometimes asking myself, like, how did I get to where I am? And, I think it actually comes down to the, maybe courage of one man who back about 30 years ago, decided to take a punt and take a risk and just hire me from the outside of the organization. And we're talking about the trade-offs here. And, I started back in 1995 with ABN AMRO. And after having a few discussions with the then CEO, he decided to give me a chance. And he took a risk. And instead of simply just leaving it to the HR or some business heads, or simply just saying, none of my business, he actually took the risk of maybe going against a little bit the usual norm, and instead of just taking somebody from the inside, he decided to say, well, maybe this boy at that time has some potential. So clearly that was a lifelong lesson to me, right, that I'm trying also to replicate in my practice, because it showed leadership, showed some courage. And also, as a CEO, he has shown that he honestly cared about talent and went that extra step, not only for me, but for many other colleagues in his practice later on. So, you know, as I said, this created not only a loyalty on my end, but from the whole team that was hired in that way. And I have to say that that cohort has become part of a very robust, long training program. A team was built that is connected even 30 years later. And again, it was just because somebody decided to do something a little bit out of the ordinary.
That he took a chance on you. So from those lessons, Deborah, we make this observation that the typical recruitment process is, you know, you scour what's out there, you search for that talent for and within those companies, and then typically this starts with recruitment. You identify the right kind of talent for that role, and then you pursue further development for that talent as a means of retaining it, right? So it's one thing to secure the talent, and it's another to recognize that, hey, this talent has the potential to go even further. Would you say that process still exists in that exact order?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, generally it does, right? You go through the identification of the talent, and you then try to create pathways and means for the talent to strive in the organization. Now, I think what has maybe changed over time is that, for global firms, it is becoming more and more challenging to attract talent. If you think about what happened after COVID, priorities of the workforce has changed. And also the new generations that we need to deal with has a very different view of what career is about. And while back in the day, and I'm kind of dating myself here, it was a big thing to join an international and just go around and see as many countries. Maybe that's not what is important to the Gen Zs and others, right? So how do you drive that so that you can create an interesting employee value proposition for talent and keep them is what is making things difficult, right? So how do we maintain a balance between the company needs global talent, but the talent may not need a global company?
Mm.
And therefore, we're trying to develop various tools that will help talent stay. And for those that we hire, we try to hire the kind of profile that wants to be with Citi. What does that mean? That our vision, that our value proposition, that our mission aligns with what they want to achieve in their lives. But equally, we're really doing a lot to develop talent locally. Like, for example, here in Singapore, we're trying to ensure that people locally have ways to learn, develop, and get various different pathways, be it jumping from one business to another, or maybe going between businesses or within the business. Now, what we're also trying to do is make sure that we keep track of, let's say, our Singaporeans, and we have about 100 of them everywhere globally, and try to see what they've learned. Can we use that by bringing them back?
Mm.
So it's a mix of tools that we constantly need to kind of balance, given the change in the talent pool and what people consider important.
Yeah, the theme I'm taking away from this is agility. You have to be nimble all the time as a leader.
Yes.
Now, Ping Soon, let's bring you into the conversation. How would you go about identifying someone whom you see the potential to not just fit the role, but the company's culture as well? That's really important. I think most often overlooked as well. But also to groom and hopefully get them to ride the company's journey as well. So it's a personal journey, as you said, Tibor, but also the company's journey is important as well. And that's always an uncertain thing. It's not a set image that we have in our minds, right? So how do we identify someone who has that ability and promise to ride the wave of the company with you, get them for the long term?
I think, thanks for the question. I would start by saying that I think leading any organization today is more difficult. And I think it is the most difficult period of times for leadership. I think over lunch, we were just talking about this whole disruption and uncertainties are just increased. Over lunch, we were just talking about nothing about this panel. We were talking about it's not even 100 days, and guess what President Trump has done? He has upended the whole economic order.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
So the geopolitical uncertainties are real. You talk about the technological disruptions, right? From ChatGPT to DeepSeek. You talk about the need for energy transition. And all this is happening When a workforce is expecting greater autonomy, greater empowerment, greater flexibility, greater mobility. So it is not easy to be a leader today. So the question is, what do you look out for? I was quite intrigued. The minister has a 5-4-3-2-1. I'm not going to have a 5-4-3-2-1. But maybe let me offer five traits of what I look for in a leader. Number one, I think no surprise, you need somebody who has some skills and competency so you can measure that kind of by IQ, right? And just now, Yoke King talked about EQ. So I think these two people are familiar with. I'll just add three more Qs, yeah, into this basket.
There's a Q for the Q.
It's a Q for the Q. Yeah, that's right. The third Q, I suppose, is LQ. I think we talked a lot about it. You know, do you look for somebody who is already is very good at that role, or somebody who may not be very good at that role, but you can sense in that person the willingness and ability to learn? The reality is that you may not know everything, and you must be prepared to do that. And I think that's what that boss of yours look out for you, right? You probably don't know a lot of the job, but you're prepared to learn. So you look for people who are no longer kind of know-it-all, but kind of learn-it-all. Mm. And I think today, in today's age, where skills are deteriorating at such a fast pace, it's absolutely important. So we look for that learning quotient. The fourth Q, and I like that picture, it's a trade-off, right? So let's talk about a serious trade-off. And I call it the values quotient. I'm sure every one of you in your organizations has values. It's probably listed somewhere.
Somewhere on the webpage.
Somewhere on the webpage, yeah. Somewhere on a wall. But is your organization living it up? Are those values actually translated to actual behaviors? And are these behaviors used as a guide for you to decide about talent? You want to talk about trade-off? Let's talk about the trade-off between values and performance. Mm. Right? So if you can imagine, any consultant will have a 2x2 box. You've got some paper and pen. If you can't visualize it, you can draw that 2x2 box on your paper. So draw a 2x2, your y-axis, performance, right? Low and high. Your x-axis, values, low and high. It's very simple when you have to deal with people on the top right-hand box. High in performance, high in values. You reward them, right? People who are on your diagonally bottom left, quite simple, right? Low in performance, low in values, replace them. Mm. But the challenge is on the other two, right? What if you have somebody who is not so good in performance? It's not incompetent, but performance level not so good. Mm-hmm. But super aligned with your organization, what do? Do you remove them? I would suggest you don't. I would suggest you, especially in Singapore, you know, when you have a very tight labor market, I think you need to redeploy. Maybe it's not a good job fit. You need to retrain them. But I think the biggest, at least for me, in the past organization I led, is to deal with that person who is up there, who is your star player, is a high performer, bring the bacon home, but very low alignment with your company. Mm. What do you do? Do you have the moral courage to actually replace that person? That's not easy.
Yeah.
So I think you really need to pay attention to that. Now, the last quotient that I will throw in, right, is what I call the personality quotient.
Okay.
Right? I think in today's day and age, positive energy is important. I think for leaders to succeed, you need to kind of know what makes you think. You need to look for people who knows how to develop and protect their mind, their body, and spirit. Right? Especially in today's uncertainty and the need to really learn and relearn. If you don't have the energy to know what does it do to make you think, it's going to be challenging. Particularly now, mm-hmm. when leaders or your people are looking for more connection with you, more authenticity, and more inspiration, you really need to find that.
Yeah.
Now, if you can find that person, let me know, because I'm looking to hire that person.
I'll take your phone number down later. And I want to be devil's advocate here, because we talk about how we hire talent, how to look out for the right talent, the right fit for our companies. What about the flip side? How do we assess and determine what to look out for in a leader that we want to follow, that we're inspired by, in order to... Because sometimes it's organic, right? It's one thing to have that box, but it's also the leader that's in charge of that box, that's overseeing that box, that needs to inspire confidence in their workers to, okay, maybe I want to be changing this. I want to be changing my attitude at work. What kind of traits must that leader have?
So the leader has to be empathetic. You know, the leader has to be able to have the honest conversation with that person. And I think, you know, people can fake it once or twice during interviews, but nothing beats some kind of reference check and just having that honest conversation and put on the person on certain assignment and really see whether is there a dissonance between what he says he do and what he actually does.
Walking the talk.
Walking the talk.
Mm. Perlin, over to you now. I wonder if you've experienced developing talent that you've eventually had to release to the big wide world after you've groomed them, you know, let them leave your company, let them leave your side to allow them to grow further. I mean, it's quite a big trade-off. It's a sacrifice as a leader to groom this person, invest so much, only to say, I think this is the end for you. I need you. I think you need to go further in life. How did that feel?
I think it all boils down to what your intent is, right? Are we building careers or are we just filling a job, right? You know, are we just looking at the talent there purely to fill up a job opening? I think it's only natural that talents are poached and targeted. That's why they are talents, right? And the more they are poached and targeted means the better the job the company must be doing in developing and exposing the person's capabilities to the industry. We don't necessarily have to look at it as a sacrifice. I think, of course, it's always, you know, with a little bit of regret that, you know, somebody that you've been investing in has decided to join the outside world, if you will, right? But I do believe that it can be a win-win for the individual and for the organization. You know, for the individual, we hope that the individual goes out, learns new experiences and comes back one day.
They realize the grass is not always greener on the other
side.
That's
right. Sometimes they just have to go out there to experience it and hopefully come back bigger, better, stronger. It also gives the organization an opportunity to ventilate and perhaps surface the next generation of new leaders into bigger roles, right? And thirdly, I do think it does a lot for the reputation of the company. Because if you develop talents well and you invest in your talent, it does speak a lot about how long-term and how sustainable the company is for the long run. So I myself have had the privilege of working for two great companies. And these two great companies have spawned many, many talents that have gone on to bigger, better things. And today, these two companies have the reputation as a breeding ground for talents and future leaders. So, you know, it does speak a lot about that, especially when it comes to talent recruitment. And when you go out to universities, for example, right, and you're able to cite past successes that you have groomed, I think that speaks a lot about the company. And it also gives food for thought for us as we lose our talents, whether it's time for us to refresh and relook and improve our own talent program as well.
Tibor, I was recently told that some people are the star talent, others are soldiers, very much like the model that you put out earlier, Ping Soon. The thing is, leaders need both. You do need both. When you look at your workforce in today's context and you're deciding how to allocate training resources for talent development, what are the trade-offs you're willing to make for that bigger outcome?
Well, banking, but I guess any organization is a team sport. So I personally, at least, don't like to think of the continuum of our talent pool as stars and then, you know, soldiers, because that implies you can kind of sacrifice them easily, and then wherever else, right? It's more like a soccer team where, you know, that particular, traditionally speaking, star who kind of always scores, you know, can't do that if there is no perfect execution along the chain. So that, of course, is one principle. The other one is we do have to have a meritocracy. And in meritocracies, back to your point, like that we have to be able to measure performance and make some tough decisions along those lines, we are developing very transparent frameworks within which everyone knows if they're a star or if they have some room to improve. So it's not going to be based on some, you know, someone's whim or some soft undefinable metrics. So that's important as well. So what we need to then also take into consideration as managers or leaders is the third concept, which is the availability of talent. And you referred to that as well, you know, here, both of the panelists, which is that we are competing in a space where we are kind of losing talent, gaining talent, producing talent just to export it. we need to make sure that that value proposition that we have, you know, remains relevant for our star performers. So therefore, in a way, what we want to achieve is that everyone knows that they can become a star within their own speciality, and then they will be taken care of. But it's equally clear and has to be clear that if somebody does not perform, it has consequence. The availability for growth and learning is there for everybody. And we at Citi believe in exposure and experience and formal education, where experience is about 70% of someone's growth. Exposure is about 20, and let's say 10 is in fact your formal learning, because you do come into a job at the end of the day learning. So what we want to do is communicate to employees that they have to take ownership of their careers as well. They have to do their part to become stars. We will definitely do everything in our power to make sure that, you know, they can perform. And of course, as you become a star, you get that much more resource.
Kingston, I want to tap on your experience here. As CEO, you'd also have to contend with competing internal priorities that are basically competing for your attention, while also mapping out how to allocate these talent development resources mm-hmm. effectively, right? Mm-hmm. You've been CEO of GovTech, a public agency, and now you're a CEO of SBF. It's a business chamber. It is an NGO. What is one thing that's worked for you in terms of the balance between delivering business results, your KPI, and investing in talent development as well at the same time?
I think it's not an either or. And first of all, I really like what Pearline said, you know, about... And I think when I listen to what you say about the two organizations that you joined, the thing that comes to my mind that those two organizations epitomizes what I call their talent factories. And now that we're the CEO of SBF, you know, I really like to call out to all businesses out there, do not be afraid to lose your talent. I think the trademark of a good organization, a great organization, is that, you know, you are a talent factory, right? You know, because about talent, circulation of talent, and you want to get boomerangs back anyway. And you want to make sure that, you know, the time that your guys spend in your organization is a CV enhancing experience and not a CV depreciation experience. But I want to go back to your question, right? That as I say, it's not an either or. I think, and one of the challenges for leaders nowadays is the managing of dualities, right? How do you deliver today and how do you transform the organization for tomorrow? How do you deal with external stakeholders to deliver value and dealing with your internal stakeholders, the largest which are employees? You mentioned GovTech, and I would say that I had the privilege to steward the GovTech for a period of 5 years. And a bit of preamble is needed so that I can share a bit of personal story if you ask me for, right? Yeah, so GovTech, it was an organization formed 6-7 years ago. At that time, it was called the Infocom Development Authority. It has three roles. Number one is a regulator of the telecoms industry, so collect a lot of licensing fees. And number two, it is a developer of the ICT industry in Singapore. And number three is the CIO for the government. So through some government reorganization, the first two roles were taken out, combined with Media Development Authority to form the well-loved IMDA that I'm sure you all know very well of in CNA. So what's left behind for GovTech is to be the CIO of the organization. So I came in at point of GovTech. In terms of organization transformation in my mind, I did not join an organization where the organization is at the fork of the road.
Right.
The decision has been taken before me, right? It is about rebuilding engineering capability for Singapore and how can you do that. So I really joined an organization at that point where I had to undergo what I call a dual transformation. It's about how do you move an organization and rebuild engineering capability for you to deliver the digital government. How do you move from project management to product management? How do you do from outsource to insource? How do you move from waterfall to agile? Hence, what can we do? What do I need to do? The challenge that I face is what I call our clothes don't fit anymore. And because when I joined organizations, it's about 1,008. When I left, it's about 4,000. And over that period of time, it's really how do you optimize the current workforce, right, to change the way you do things, but at the same time build a new capacity so that the what is also different. So in a way, it's a dual transformation. And doing that is not easy. And it goes back to the value quotient, right? There are some people who may not be very good performers, but align with the organization. Do you kind of sack them all and then bring a new bunch? You can't. But to grow that new what, you have to pay special attention. So long story short, we had to set up a government digital services, hire a bunch of people, which is a very different profile from what we had in 2008. And we got to set it up very differently, even put it away from the main HQ, different pay scheme, different career path, and so on and so forth. It looks good. It goes on. But what do you do as a leader when you have both trying to transform the optimizing the current workforce and build a new workforce? If you don't do it well, you end up a very bimodal organization. You end up against us, against them. So how do you then thoughtfully build the capabilities, the process, and the linkages between the people who are in the existing as well as them? And the way I think about it, and I like, since it was from Minister Desmond Lee, and he was using the urban planning metaphor. So I will explain to and the way we think about it in GovTech, an organization of 4,000 people, is to remind everybody that, yes, everybody has a role. And it's quite useful to use this metaphor, and it's not soldiers and stars. It's really saying that I need people who are pioneers, Minister used that word, people who can bring from zero to one. But I need the settlers too, people who can bring from one to 10. But then I need town planners too, people who can bring 10 to 100 because the whole system is wide. The challenge for any leader is how do you find the right people in each of these, get them to understand that they all need to work together and deliver on the mission.
That's right. Using the two together. We are coming close to the Q&A session now, so I hope that you've taken the time to scan that QR code and to submit what questions you have for our panelists. We're not done with them yet. There will be more opportunities to hear them speak. Thank you for sharing your initial thoughts with us, panelists. Let's move on now to the Q&A session now. Let me just pick this up from the pigeonhole situation here. So, the first question that's come up on the Q&A, and this is addressed to all of you, please let me know if you would like to answer first. What is the one trait that you think is the greatest predictor of an employee's career path to reach CEO? This is a question my husband asks me every day. Can you go and be a CEO so that I can play music every day of his life? So I'm not going to ask you to identify if I can be CEO, but what would be the predictor? Perlin, you want to take this one?
I won't say it's a predictor, but, you know, it's just causing me to reflect on some trade-offs that, you know, I, in my experience, have had to make when we come towards identifying leadership or potential leaders. It's really about matching ambition, aspiration with ability and aptitude. So sometimes you have somebody who has so much potential, you see the potential in the person, and you see that the person is going to make big strides and is going to do really well. But I think it is equally important to match the person's ambition and aspiration and whether the person wants to get there. Because oftentimes, you know, no matter how hard you try to drag it out of the person and you see that this guy is going to do so well, if he doesn't have the aspiration to do it, he can be a theoretical CEO material, but he will never want to be.
A reluctant CEO. While I have you speaking to us, Perlin, there's another question that is specific for you. What was the most significant trade-off you made that paid off handsomely?
Wow. Well, if I reflect on my own career, I've always been a career banker and always in distribution, in sales, in consumer banking, in wealth management, never been in a manufacturing role. And as I look back 4 years ago, joining Singlife was like crossing over to the dark side, right? We always say you've crossed over to the dark side. It was a gamble. But I have to say it gave me the opportunity to build a company, to build a culture, to bring people together and to serve a better good. And we truly believe the insurance industry is here to really protect everyone and not just to sell you the next policy. So I think, you know, it was a gamble at that time. It was a little bit of getting out of my comfort zone. But looking back, you know, I think it has really paid off personally, and professionally.
Okay, there are a couple of questions that are pretty similar, and I think it's an interesting one as well. Sometimes talents may be mismatched in a different industry, has developed in a different industry from yours. Would you consider them? What would make them appealing if they do not have direct experience? Tibor, do you want to take this one?
Can I get the previous one?
No, sorry, Mr. Turn.
No, absolutely. In fact, as we hire, we already... look outside what would be the usual finance training, right, or a usual business school. We have people who have studied sociology, anthropology, natural sciences. So comes back to the adaptability that we've been talking about of our hiring policies to what the talent pool looks like. And as a bank, we are not only about, you know, selling your next credit card or a loan or a structured transaction. There's so many other things. And we, as we are part of society, we also need to be staffed with people who come from different parts of the society. So the answer is absolutely and emphatically yes.
I'll take a stab at that, and I would say absolutely yes. I think increasingly you shouldn't just be hiring for subject matter expertise. You look for adjacency skills. And I'll go back, and my quick answer to that one trait of the Qs that I mentioned, I'll pick LQ, yeah. Right? It is really that ability, with that hunger, the ability to learn and relearn that we are really looking for, because today nobody knows it all. Yeah. So I think really focus on that.
Yeah. And if I can add on, right, I think, you know, you definitely need the core bench strength, right? Subject matter specialist. But today's world is so complicated and complex that, you know, as I look back when we grew Sing Life, I mean, we are hiring people from CMA, for instance, right? We have a lawyer.
Be careful, your king, she's looking. She's not selling policies, she's looking for your people.
I'm saying, my boss is here, I'm saying.
No, we've hired our head of HR is a legally trained, right? So we are looking at people with very different exposures and very different mindsets. We like lawyers, we like engineers, and we are in the financial industry. So I definitely believe that, you know, groupthink is a big problem, and needs are getting so complex that you really need skills and exposures from very different disciplines.
There are so many questions to get through, but we have time for just one more, and I'm going to pick this one because I think it is a perennial problem for many leaders out there. How can you do the right but unpopular thing while still getting support from your staff? And I think this is open to all of you.
Well, maybe I can take a stab at it. All of us have to do this, right? In my experience, there is only one strategy that always works, and that is total transparency.
That's right.
You know, you build trust every day with everything you do. And even if you do something that is not popular or hard, people will not like it, but hopefully they will over time understand it. If you do these things consistently through good times and bad times, you know, you will build that trust and that credibility that then you can use when times, you know, get tough. So that, you know, being just honest with people is something that I found always worked. And then fair, because at the end, people want respect and want to be treated with respect, even if, you know, whatever the decision is may not go in their favor. So that was, you know, the thing that worked for me. I don't know.
Just quickly, absolutely, you know, the honesty is the best policy. But also then back it up, you know, by being authentic and most importantly, engage. You know, just have to kind of keep over-engaging.
I think open communication is important. I do think, I mean, apart from talent management, right, just really sharing the rationale and the logic behind specific key strategic initiatives or directives that the company has decided to pursue, whether the person is, the group is junior, not junior, top team or not, I do think that when people understand why the company has chosen to adopt or go towards a certain direction, you get more buy-in and execution will become a lot better.
Ibor, Perlin, Ping Soon, thank you once again for gracing the stage with me today, sharing your experience, your advice as well, and insights with us today. These are really nuanced perspectives on reconciling, you know, conflicting objectives, a lot of things competing for your attention as CEO, as leaders, especially when you have a strategy that you have to achieve. It's an unenviable position to be in, certainly. And, you know, it's a constantly evolving environment also, as we all pointed out, especially today. Your insights have been absolutely valuable. So thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now take a short break of about 30 minutes, light snacks, drinks available to you, and it will be served at your table. So you can just sit and hang out. And while you're munching, we're going to bring you a preview of a CNA program called Singapore's Balancing Act on Trade-offs. And welcome back to the YouTube and LinkedIn live stream of the CNA Summit, Trade-Offs in Leadership. I'm Elizabeth Neo, your host for this segment. Now, we've just heard from our Singapore Minister for National Development, Desmond Lee, and our panelists from the first session, which looked at the internal trade-offs that business leaders face. Now, this examined the tough choices that they must make on internal dynamics within the organization that impact internal stakeholders, of course, the processes and resources like talent management, resource allocation, organizational design, leadership style, cultural transformation, just to name a few. And before that, we also heard from MediaCorp CEO, Ms. Tamlok King, who talked about the landscape that we face today that's come to be defined by the acronym VUCA, which is volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity, and the considerations that business leaders have to make in navigating. And of course, there's plenty more coming up today right here at the summit at Pan Pacific Singapore, including another panel discussion and more live interviews with business leaders and other heads of organizations. Now, before we move on to our next interview, allow me to take a moment to just thank our partners for the CNA Summit, Trade-Offs in Leadership. Our presenting partner is Sing Life. Our impact partner is the National Volunteer and Philanthropy Center, or NPVC. And our main partner is OVO.
We're done with our dream eco home. Thanks to our helpful neighbor. Now, we can finally start on that 50,000-piece jigsaw puzzle.
Sorry to interrupt. EcoHome, jigsaw puzzles.
Possible?
Can. SingLife has a plan for you. But I can't promise Pierre Pung.
Whatever your dream, SingLife is here to help you achieve it with financial freedom. A better way.
When you look after your people, they will look after the customers and the business will take care of each other. So every time we are faced with a challenge, we choose purpose because we want to serve the communities within which we operate.
At Greenpack, partnership is very important to us. We like to do business with like-minded companies who has a mission of contributing to the future of sustainability.
I feel it deep in my bones. Weightless and they're born. Skyline fades and all we know is riding where the dreams are born.
Welcome back. You're watching the YouTube and LinkedIn live stream at CNA Summit 2025. Now, balancing profit and purpose is no easy task, especially in a small country like Singapore. And so joining us to share how the NVPC navigates this is Tony So, CEO of the National Volunteer and Philanthropy Center. So Tony, it's really good to talk to you again at
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
The National Volunteer and Philanthropy Center's mission is to promote a culture of volunteerism and philanthropy.
Yes.
But how do you bridge profit and purpose?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. I think for us to promote the culture of philanthropy and volunteerism, obviously we want to go for all Singaporeans to get involved because it's a culture. So on one part, we do digital giving through digitalgiving.sg. That becomes a digital platform that we invite all Singaporeans to give in their different ways. Of course, we work with non-profits. But when we talk about profit and purpose, really the point is that apart from trying to engage individual Singaporeans, a good place to get them started in volunteerism and donations and so forth is really through the companies, through the places where they work. And so we want to be able to encourage companies to begin to understand that their role in society can be very important because they have lots of resources. You know, they have financial, human, intellectual resources. And where companies think that they could in the past do corporate social responsibility and it's one-off, it's by the way, we are thinking of how we can convert them and help them think about going from corporate giving to corporate purpose. And the purpose really is that beyond making profits, the purpose of an organization is really to have much greater impact on society, to be a force for good in society. And so that's the work we do. We try and encourage companies to do that. And in doing so, I think we mobilize large numbers of people who work in these companies to begin to give, to volunteer, to donate, but and also to engage in other areas like skilled volunteering, you know, contributing their skills to charities, contributing the way that they can mobilize their friends, they can also advocate for causes. So it really helps us, you know, in terms of mobilizing companies, it provokes an aspect of volunteerism that really helps accelerate this, the idea that everyone can give.
It's interesting because we talk about resources.